This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. And the car was a hero today because it actually started. So the car has been a hero since many weeks ago when it stranded me. Like one of the other programmers is going out to his car. Bye, Justin. Have a good weekend. Bye. Justin, good man. Lots of good men working. Lots of good men and one good woman. We have one woman up in the entire IT department up in there. And the programmers and the database administrations. And good. They're all good people. Good people. So diligent, hardworking. Want to do the best job they know how to do. Not without challenges, but nonetheless, good people. Good people to work with. I am honored and privileged. Anyways, it is episode 340, which, let's see, 7 years worth of episodes would be 7 years. Worth of episodes, 7 times 52 would be 364, I think, if I did that right on a tired brain. So we are at 340, which means there's 24 more episodes to go to 7 years worth of podcasts, which means that we are over halfway through the next block of years, because it comes up in March. So, anyways, it's been a good week. Dad is getting stronger. I'm going over every week and emptying out his catheter, and so get a chance to see him every day right now and make sure he's doing okay and change bandage as needed, although we're down to a Band-Aid where they put in the drain for his bile on the gallbladder, so that seems to be okay. We're going to go see the doctor in a couple of weeks on that. We're going to go see the urologist a week from tomorrow, and hope that when they take out, well, hope they're going to try to take out the catheter, a week from tomorrow and see if he can pee. So we'll see. I think he would be very happy if he could actually pee on his own, because he is tired of walking around with that little cart we've got him behind, the little four-wheeled kind of walker thing. So, you know, hopefully that's going to get resolved, not this week, but next week, so we'll see. So that's going fine. Sent out all of the books for Windfall the Straight Gate this week. People have expressed excitement over reading it. Hopefully they won't be disappointed. This is always kind of the time of tension, you know? It's always a little interesting because you think, yeah, okay, I've written this thing and it's going to be fine, you think, but you never really know till you start getting some reactions back from the beta readers. I am more encouraged about this one than I was about the last one. I felt like the last one was just way too long. You know, it just kind of, it sagged a little in the middle, especially in the beta version, because I had gotten a little verbose on my recaps, and I knew something wasn't right about it, but I didn't know what. You know, as I read it, I thought I was just being diligent in my recaps. of connecting the characters together as we move from scene to scene. But one of my beta readers said, yeah, you're telling me stuff I already know, which he was right. Unfortunately, he has had a new child, I think, and in the intervening time, he doesn't have time to beta read anymore, so unfortunately, I've lost him to beta reading for the moment. Perhaps when the child is a bit older and settled, maybe I'll get him back, but for right now, I've lost him, so. So at the end of the second one, by the time I actually got through it, I just started going through and cutting all that stuff out. And it really lightened up the whole book. It made it move faster. And I cut 20 some odd pages out of the book. And I think 8,000 words, something like that, out of the book. And so that dropped it back down to where I was a lot happier with it after I got it all cut. I don't think I've done that in this one. I try to kind of learn my lesson and, you know, pay attention to that. Not necessarily recap stuff, but just keep the momentum of the story moving forward. So I think it's going to be okay. There's several spots where I feel like we have hit the moment. I have hit the moment in it. Makes me tear up at least, you know, so it doesn't, for me, have as dramatic and a sustained moment as the second book has. But then again, one of my beta readers told me that the epilogue really didn't do much for him, because the whole moment in the epilogue of the second book really swirls around a daughter's relationship to her father, and he has not had the pleasure of that experience yet, and so it didn't really connect with him. But there was another spot in the book that connected much more to him. So, you know, we still got to it with him, we just got to it in a different spot. This book actually has four potential spots in it to connect to people emotionally, besides just humor, you know. But the epilogue is purposely a little odd in the way it connects. Because if it affects other people the way it affects me, by design, it's going along, you know, there's not much really emotional happening, although you can tell, okay, it's all going someplace, it's coming, and then there is this quick emotional pop. I mean, it's like a paragraph and a half, and it just comes out of nowhere. Just like you're reading, okay, fine, and then it's like, bam, it's a sucker punch. And then right when you're in it, just as you get into it, then it yoinks you out of it, and you completely lose it. But then that's kind of the primer. And then it kind of takes off in another direction, but then it starts building back up and looping back, and, you know, hopefully all the pieces are in there to get it aligned and to give you the satisfying ending. Maybe not satisfying ending, but an ending that is emotive. So it's going to be interesting to see how people react to that, because they may think what I've done on the epilogue is a mistake, but in fact it was exactly what I wanted to happen. I could have changed it around to where I would have sat in the moment longer, but in order to sit in the moment longer and not have the kind of sucker punch and then pull back and then, you know, revisit, recapitulation type thing, I would have been untrue to the characters. And that's what I realized when I was in the middle of working on the epilogue for book three, is that, yeah, I can force this to happen, but I open myself to criticism of you just violated your character, and it is not believable that a character who has been through what this character has just been through would go down that path. And so in being true to the character, I had to allow for there to be a simple, quick moment that would then get obliterated by a reaction that I could then build on and get back into the moment again. And hopefully that won't be too disorienting. But hopefully it will build up and, you know, make it make sense in the long run. The only other concern I have about the epilogue on book three is that it is long. Typically, I try to make my chapters about 12 to 13 pages long. It's not unusual for them to stretch to 16, sometimes 17 pages. But that's sort of the pacing that I like to keep it at. The epilogue is 24 pages because it takes place in a completely different environment. So you have to spend some time setting up that environment because the environment's important, and then you have to spend some time establishing the character who is in this environment, and then you have to spend some time allowing that character to be on the quest, and then finally you get to the character's interaction with something that is known. And so all of those pieces just take time, and I suppose I could break it into epilogue one and epilogue two. Which, you know, is a possibility. So I'll see what, if I get too many beta readers saying, yeah, the epilogue was really long, you know, then I may break it into epilogue one and epilogue two. Just give people a natural break point to where they, you know, feel like it's not, or maybe I'll break it into a pre-epilogue and an epilogue, you know. So maybe that's what I should have done. I'll have to consider that. See, in talking through these things, sometimes you get an idea. Anyways, so that's all well. Family's all well. All is well. All is well. All is well. Had nice break. Had one or two good breakfasts with friends this week. Always enjoy getting together with my friends to talk. I mean, it's just, had a couple of breakfasts this week, and then also had a walk with a buddy. So that's three. So it was good. Everything was good. It was good, good, good. In the time we have left, which is not too long, I found an article that I kind of started reading through it, and I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. So I bookmarked it and kind of came back to it and studied it some more. And it's a sociologist who is talking about how we experience emotion. And, you know, he has this theory, and that he claims that we are, in fact, in Western societies, post-emotional. And this all comes down to the fact, what got him thinking about this, because I think it's important to put it in context as to what he's trying to prove or understand, even though the writer of the article held this until the very end of the article and simply put forth the theories first and then decided, now that you've got the theories and you're in your brain, then this is the result of them, and this is why you're doing that. And I remember reading through this article and then getting to what he's trying to understand and thinking, I don't think that's what's causing that. So what he was trying to understand and what he was trying to explain, this sociologist, Stepan, which is S-T-J-E-P-A-N, so I'm assuming it's Stepan, anyways, I'm not even going to try the last, so it's Mestrovic or something. It's a sociologist, and what got him thinking about this was the bland global response to the Bosnian genocide in the 90s. But the author of the article said it, in their opinion, it applies equally well to the slow, stuttering response, both political and personal, to the refugees fleeing the Syrian civil war. So this theory of what's going on with our emotions and the fact that he believes we now live in a post emotional society is based on the fact that in his mind we don't have a more general, genuine emotional reactions to situations like the Bosnian genocide in the 1990s, or the Rwanda genocide, or the plight of the Syrian refugees. Okay, so at its core, I have a completely different idea about why we experience emotion that we'll get to eventually. And so I think at its core, because I have a different idea about why we experience emotion, and because as a writer, one of my skill sets that I value is the ability to evoke emotion in others just from words, I have a different, an obviously different interpretation and an obviously different valuation of the use of emotion in creative enterprises. But we'll go through his stuff, first of all. So he believes that we're in a post-emotional society. And because he thinks that we have become numb to our emotions, not that we don't express emotions, but that we become numb and do not feel them the way we once did. And that's a result of being exposed to a daily diet of phoniness, a barrage of emotional manipulation from every corner of culture, news, entertainment, infotainment, and advertising. And he says, you know, every company out there is trying to manipulate your emotion and trying to make you feel something. And one of the examples they gave was as a gum company, Extra Gum. And the ad is that a dad is sitting with his young daughter, and he gives her a piece of gum, and he takes a piece of gum, and then he takes the wrapper and he folds it up into this tiny little swan, and he gives it to her, and she plays with it. And then you see him a few years later, and he does the same thing, and he does the same thing, and the same thing. You see the girl getting older and older and older and older, and he does the same thing. And you see them going through adolescence where she doesn't want to listen, but he still folds one up and puts it down on her book, you know, and she kind of gives him a little small smile, and she takes it, and goes on and on and on. And then you see the daughter, and she's getting ready to go to college, and the dad is helping carry things out, and as he's putting things in the car, he accidentally knocks a box off the top of a stack, and it spills out, and here in this box are the hundreds of these little foil wrappers that have been folded into swans that she has saved. And of course, there's a little emotional moment there, and it's cute, it's nice. So he would maintain that, in fact, those types of things, that phony exploitation that every time you turn around, that someone is trying to make you happy by showing you pictures of kittens, or someone to gain views, or someone is trying to write stories that will evoke tension, or evoke tears, or evoke laughter, that all of that is building up and you just become inured to real emotion, that you become numb to all this. And this is the explanation for why, when we see people in dire straits, when we see groups of people in dire straits, we do not feel for them as deeply as we might. I'm getting my mail, one moment. So that's kind of, they've got a new financial website. Oh, well, isn't that nice? looked like a commercially produced application there, or a commercially produced postcard, but it's actually just some friends. They produce very nice postcards. So, anyways, and they were just calling to, or writing to thank you for some of the work that we had done at AGWM. So, yay. Good. I'm glad it's useful for them. So, anyways, and he said the problem is that these experiences that we're being fed constantly are so much more intense than those atypical human experiences in their daily lives. And the onslaught is so constant that this sociologist thinks we are emotionally exhausted by this experience, leaving little energy, in his words, little energy, or in her words, whoever's writing this article, and her name, who was writing the article, is Lisa Wade. Let's see, to feel our own idiosyncratic emotions. So this is the basic contention, that society is overloading us with emotion and therefore robbing us of the ability to feel our own emotions. You know, according to the article, we lose our ability to detect our more nuanced emotions, which are almost always small and mundane compared to the extraordinary heights of grief, rage, lust, and love that we are exposed to when the news chases down the latest mass tragedy or movies offer up never-ending tales of epic quests. Now, we'll come back to that in a minute. While in consuming the emotions of others, we get lost, we end up confused by the dissolving of the boundaries between the personal and the vicarious. We can't tell the difference between friends on TV and those in life. Okay, so et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the upshot of it is that the emotional dilution that characterizes a post-emotional society makes us less likely to take heed when action is needed. So when action is needed, we change our Facebook profile instead of taking to the streets. Now, okay, so the contention, the general contention here, is that if we were not inundated by emotions from society, fake emotions or hyper emotions, that we would express deeper outrage at what's going on in the world. There may be a sense that that's true, but I don't think that it expresses what I consider to be a proper understanding of why people emote. And I've had this theory for a long time that people emote, and the level of their emoting is directly connected to their self-identity in somewhere, their self-definition. I remember years ago reading about or hearing about a theory where the guy said something about, you know, when thousands of people get killed overseas, it doesn't affect us. But when there's a spider in the car, then, you know, we get all upset. And one lady jumped out and crashed her car. Saw that picture here recently. And that the reason for that was some sort of a deep evolutionary reaction that was built into us. And my contention is the reason that you get less emotional about 1,000 people dying overseas and more emotional about a spider in your car is because there is a real threat to your self-identity, or at least an imagined threat to your self-identity and self-definition with this spider in the car, because it might bite you and then you might get a big swollen place or your skin might rot off. And so that's why we have this big emotion, because there is a connection to our identity. It's the same reason we have big emotions when a parent dies, even though we might not have been on a good relationship with that parent, because they're part of our self-identity. It's something that we can relate to. It's the reason that there is an outrage when a single boy washes up dead on a shore and we see someone carrying them out, as opposed to thousands of people being slaughtered. Because there is an identification. What if that was our child? And we can then resonate with that. And all of these examples that they're giving of things that connect with us emotionally, for instance, that gum commercial. The reason that I react to that emotionally, or that people react to that emotionally, is it's validation. We are all in a situation where we are looking for validation. And one of the things that can create a tremendous amount of angst in our lives is hoping that we are doing the right thing by our children, that our actions are actually causing something of benefit. And when we see that our children have cherished something that we have done, then that causes our self-definition to be more validated. It causes our actions to be validated, and in the process, it impacts our self-definition, our self-worth, and therefore there is emotion. And I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing, because in the invocation of those noble emotions, I think there's a difference between being exposed to the ignoble emotions, fear, of loss, fear of want, anxiety over uncertainty. Those things do bring about an emotional response as well, but they are ignoble. Whereas there is emotions that I consider to be noble emotions, and I am happy to evoke those every day, all day long. It is Luke Skywalker and Hans Solo at the end of Star Wars: A New Hope, coming up to receive their medals as all watch on. Because I think that display of validation, that display of transcendence, where those who were one thing that was considered small have grown and become another thing that is considered valiant. I think in the process of dwelling on those things, we can imagine ourselves being validated. We can imagine ourselves transcending. We can imagine ourselves being reunited. Reunion is another one of those noble things that evokes the noble emotion. We can imagine ourselves sacrificing for others, which is another thing that evokes a noble emotion. At this point in my life, I've got those four, which is validation, transcendence, reunion, and sacrifice. And I think us experiencing those can cause us to become aware that those are worthwhile things to strive for. Not necessarily to run out, run around and try to get everyone to validate us, but to behave in such a way that it evokes validation. To be noble, to be true, to be generous, to be kind, to be merciful. To behave in such a way that it is labeled as transcendent. To not be tied down by your circumstances, but instead to rise above your circumstances. To not be labeled as small and be content to remain within those labels, but to strive to rise above and become more that you are. That can cause us to seek reunion, seek to be reunited with those with whom we are separated, but there is a vested interest that we have imparted in their lives. I think that's noble, and I think that's worthwhile. And then finally, all that sacrifice, that the emotion that is invoked in sacrifice, I think can make us more willing, can make us more in touch with the desire to sacrifice ourselves for others. Because instinctively, as we watch those examples, we understand that the reason that we are experiencing this noble emotion is because someone sacrificed themselves for other. And that remembrance of that can serve as an example that might guide us to do the same. And so I think the noble emotions can actually inspire our behavior. And therefore, instead of wearing us out, instead of causing us to be numb, they actually attune us to the potential of what might be available in our lives if we apply ourselves, if we give ourselves, if we make ourselves available to the moment. So I really don't find the evocation of the noble emotions to be unbeneficial. I do find the ignoble emotions to be unbeneficial, although sometimes it's fun just to do that too. You know, the scary movies that are just meant to make you jump and or try to gross you out or try to, you know, sometimes I watch those just to understand the craft. You know, and just the doomsday stuff, the fear-based emotions that were ginned up, for instance, by the whole Schmidtga and Harbinger stuff and the blood moons and all that kind of stuff. It's October 1st, people. Ta-da! Big surprise. Nothing happened. Although some of the guys that were preaching and pushing all that now are saying, well, we never said it was what exactly was going to happen. We just gave some examples. Well, okay, but by your conduct and by your speech, you very clearly used the fear of catastrophe to move people forward. And I think that, the usage of that and the promulgation of that and the pounding of that is unuseful. Because that does make people numb. Because they just get to the point where they just get cynical when their emotions have been manipulated into fear over and over and over again, and there was nothing to fear. So I think you have to look at the emotions for what they are and what their reaction is within the human psyche. And you have to understand that there are ignoble emotions, that there are noble emotions. And I truly believe that the evocation of those noble emotions can actually make our lives better, which is the reason that I try to do it as a writer. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.